Well, hello out there in podcast land, and welcome back to the Front Row Networks, and welcome to a Full Disclosure, where we take a deep dive into the latest new releases and tell you if they're worth your time. I'm your host for this episode, Lou Hare. I am typically on the Guilty Pleasures podcast, and when we decide we want to do some bracket shows, I'm that guy too. But I'm very excited to talk about this movie. It's a movie I have been wanting to talk about. I've been wanting to see for a very long time, probably over 20 years in the making. So I'm happy to not only have seen this movie, but to get to talk about it. We're going to be talking about Bill and Ted Face the Music, the slightly direct-to-video on-demand release, although there was a very small theatrical release, as we are in the times we're all living in. It chose to go straight to VOD pretty much for all of us, which was great because that means we all got to see it and share it pretty much at the same time. But joining me tonight to get all up in it and talk about it, first and foremost, please welcome one of the co-hosts of Flashbacks, Mr. Scott McFarlane. How's it going, Scott?
I think I've been stuck in a phone booth for about a year since the last time I did a Full Disclosure. So it's awesome.
Probably, you know.
Well, I do like one flashback a year, so I guess I'm a co-host. Sure.
Well, that's about as many movies as I actually see in a year, new ones. So,
well, technically, you know, it's 2020. No one sees any new movies anymore.
Exactly.
You go to your kids and say, back in the day, we actually had movie theaters and they had movies in them. Mm-hmm.
And rounding out the panel tonight, somebody I've never gotten to podcast with, but I'm enjoying having him on. He is the host of the Lincoln's Legend podcast and a pioneer in a very specific way, which I will get to in a minute. Please welcome Mr. Jeremy Bailey. How's it going, Jeremy?
Thank you so much for the kind words. I'm really excited to be a part of this. Just one, to get to meet you in kind of IRL, because I've been a fan of the brackets for a really long time. And Scott, I miss your face. I'm such a huge fan of everything the Front Row does, and I've been searching for a high school that doesn't exist for most of my adult life, so this is very important to me. Thank you.
Cool. Well, thank you. And you know, Zoom meetings are pretty much real life at this point, so I think this counts. I'm counting it. I'm excited to have Jeremy on, not only because I know he's a big fan of Bill and Ted, but also because he broke new ground, ladies and gentlemen. He has become the first patron to the Front Row Network. If you haven't heard on some of our most recent podcasts, we have started a Patreon so that we can continue giving you not just the same content that we've been giving you, but giving you more content, giving you special bonus episodes and lots of different tiers and exciting things. Also to help us support this podcast so that we can continue to grow and expand, increase our equipment, increase our technology. As you can see, we're all highly adept people. Maybe we can even get somebody to teach us how to use all of this stuff that we might be using. But anyway, if you feel so inclined, you can find us on Patreon. You can look up the Front Row Network. There's a link to our Patreon on our Facebook page as well as on our Twitter feed. So Jeremy, I want to thank you for being the first of what we hope to be our many patrons. And in fact, if you are a Patreon member and you do donate a join on certain levels, we will bring you on as a guest host for whatever show you want to do. This is a happy accident that we're having Jeremy on for this one, and he just also happens to be our first patron. But I wanted to not only thank you, Jeremy, for supporting us, but also encourage others to join.
I'm really excited to break the ice, though, and I will push it for as long as I can, and I will educate people for as long as I can, because I don't think it's not supporting a show. It's supporting passionate people and beautiful content. And if you're going to spend $5 at Dunkin', at Starbucks, at any local place, Custom Cup, anywhere that you get coffee, you can also share that same revenue with a podcaster that's putting their entire life into content just like this, and I'm excited to break the ice, so you don't have to thank me. I'm happy to support you.
Did you say passionate people and beautiful content, or beautiful people and passionate content? Which one was it?
I've been excited about PP for a long time, passionate people. So,
all right. Well, let's get into it. Bill and Ted Face the Music, a movie that has been talked about for decades, whether or not it was ever actually going to happen, but it does. So what we're going to do here in full disclosure is we're going to just talk a couple of minutes up front, spoiler-free. If you haven't seen the movie, you get a chance to hear our thoughts. We'll give you the spoiler alert in case you do not want to be spoiled to any of the major plot points or you know whether or not Bill and Ted actually do save the world or not this time. We'll hold that off. So first and foremost, let's go around and just get your quick spoiler-free impression of Bill and Ted Face the Music. Jeremy, let's start with you.
I cried 8 times, but this movie, I thought it was going to be for me. Well, first, forgive me. I didn't think it was going to be for me, and I didn't think it was going to be as exciting, because with reboots or prolonged stories or second chapters or whatever you want to call this, I was like, you know what? There's going to be crazy things in it, and it's not for me, but I'm still going to love it. And I cried 8 times. I cried every time I saw that special thing that I felt was written just for me. And it might have been written for everybody. I don't know. I felt that there were some parts in it that some actors may have needed a little bit of time to get their feet back into the characters, and others just fell right into it. And it was absolutely beautiful. The message is great. It's a nice addition to the message that they were putting before. You know, you can just unite the world with music, and the way that they did this was just, it was beautiful. And I'm hoping that's the best spoiler-free answer that I can give.
Cool. All right, Scott, how about you?
I can say they all die because it's in the trailer.
True. Fair.
So, I mean, I feel that's not a spoiler if it's in the trailer.
No.
But no, I being an 80s kid like you three, or two, there's two of you there. Hi. Obviously, Bill and Ted has been something that, you know, has been in our zeitgeist for forever. But honestly, I was never really a huge fan of the franchise. I think Bogus Journey was better than the original, and I've only seen both of them maybe a handful of times in the past 30 some odd years. But I was very much interested in checking this one out just because it looked like it was going to be fun. And just, you know, the nostalgic piece of it was pretty interesting. That being said, I can't think of a better movie to come out in 2020, because damn, we needed this movie right now. I do really appreciate, even though it is a revitalization, and it's definitely leaning heavily on the nostalgia. A lot of times when you have movies about what used to be kids now dealing with adulthood, it becomes the doldrums of adulthood and just the angsty nature of Gen Xers and millennials who are getting old. I look at like Clerks 2 for that. You know, it's just like everything is kind of just like, this is a vibrant, happy, positive movie where nothing is negative, nothing is done as kind of an underhanded joke. It is just pure joy, and hell, 2020 needed that bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm with both of you. I look, there was I kind of joked when we were discussing who was going to do this for the front row, because I was like, well, if anybody sees my name on this, no one who has ever listened to me or interacted with me regarding movies is going to be surprised about this. I love this movie. I'm a massive Keanu Reeves fan. The excitement of getting to see him revisit this character along with Alex Winter already had me hooked. And all I was hoping for was that it was going to be it could have been 90 minutes of pandering nostalgia porn, and I probably still would have enjoyed myself. The fact that it wasn't is not just like a credit to them, it's kind of a minor miracle that they were able to find a way to do something that was itself engaging in its own way and wasn't just like playing the hits. And I like what you said, Scott, because one of the things I did go back and rewatch the first two movies getting ready for this, and it struck me that of all like the pairings that we hear, because Bill and Ted kind of get lumped in with like Wayne and Garth and Beavis and Butthead and Jay and Silent Bob and Cheech and Chong and all that, all of those pairings to a certain degree have kind of that level of cynicism to them. Like, in even in like Wayne's World, which is a happy movie, Wayne's basically like an ass to everybody but Garth. And Beavis and Butthead are, you know, are kind of mean-spirited. Jane, Silent Bob can be mean-spirited. There's nothing mean-spirited about Bill and Ted. There's no real cynicism behind those movies. And to have a movie like what you said, Scott, that's not cynical at all. This movie is very earnest, and it plays incredibly well on that level. I think this movie should not have been as good as it is. And so I'm excited to talk about why. But yeah, if you haven't seen it yet, I guess maybe before we move on, you know, it is on video on demand. It's available for $19.99 to rent or $24.99 to purchase. How do both of you feel about those price points? Given the fact that you know, you can't really see them in theaters unless you know your city happens to have a drive-in. Do you feel for people who haven't seen it, do you think it's worth either of those prices, and which would you recommend? Scott, we'll start with you.
Well, in a time when Disney wants to gouge you $35 for a movie you've already seen twice, yeah, $20 is great. For me, like I said, I've only watched these movies a handful of times. I'm probably not going to go back and watch this one a whole lot. So rental seems good to me, but if you're a fan of this franchise, or if you're just a fan of just good, fun 80s nostalgic movies, then buying for $25 isn't going to kill you.
All right. How about you, Jeremy?
So let's talk about who this movie is for and where we are right now as far as marketing this film. We don't have the option of going unless, like you said, to a drive-in. I'd like to think that 50% of this movie's audience are parents, and 50% of this audience needs that on-demand where they really want to watch it. They want to go down that rabbit hole and enjoy that journey. And it's beautiful. And the other audience that wants to go out and see it, then yeah, I mean, they can go out of their way to see it and have that cinematic experience. But I think it's beautiful. And from a price point, being a content creator or filmmaker or photographer or anything, this movie costs, I mean, I don't know what the actual budget was, and I'm sure someone else will correct it, but say it's $1 million movie. And you want me to pay $30 to see $1 million movie? Yes, I will give you my $30. Mm-hmm. And that's to keep it, especially when, you know, as Scott said, we have these streaming services that are, you have a handful of them and they're $30 a month. You've got these others that are $15 a month. And that's to watch it when they want it to be available for you instead of being able to go back as many times as you want. Now, being a lifelong fan of this IP, I had to have it. I have both of the DVDs, I have both of the Blu-rays, and it just makes sense to have this. I mean, it's at this point with the movie, without going into it, it's McDonald's for your soul, and it's popcorn, and it's exciting, and you need that comfort food. And I know that I can turn it on anytime that I want, and I don't have to wait for someone else to say, oh, we're only going to have this, you know, twice a year, or it's a special feature or something. Like, as far as the access and the content, absolutely, it's 100% worth it. For the things that we spend in life that are commoditized, I'm happy to give you $30 for this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think this movie has a rewatchability to it. And I know that because I've already seen it twice. And so I've watched it twice, I think within a week, and both times. And again, it is 90 minutes. So it's a very, it's not a lot of your time, but it's also it's a very breezy watch in that obviously it's not, the movie's not too convoluted. It's pleasant. Feels like I'm being condescending, and I don't mean that, but it is just that kind of movie that you could put on at any time, I think, and get in and just smile, and you don't even have to watch it all the way through. I think it's a good price point for it. I'm very curious to see how this movie does in VOD, because we know that, you know, some more family oriented titles like Trolls did really well, and Scoob did pretty well, I guess. But I'm interested to see how a movie like this, that, you know, was intended to be a late summer release, is doing with that kind of price. But and that's also going to tell us where we go. Also, the other part, this is not a giant spectacle movie like a Mulan or a Tenet, where it's like you feel like you might be missing something by having it on the big screen. I think it plays absolutely fine. I don't think you're necessarily missing anything by doing that. So
I will say though on that, I'm all for having video on demand sooner because, well, it's hard to get out to the theaters even on a normal non-pandemic time. But it's kind of disappointing that a movie like this that was a labor of love for so many people for over two decades kind of dropped, and it got some good buzz when it came out in VOD, but we're already a couple weeks past that. And it seems like it's already kind of evaporated into the wind. And I think if it was had been in the theaters and gotten at least one or two good weeks of a run, you would probably hear more people, not the ones who are like us who are going to watch it anyway, but more of the norms watching this movie and enjoying it, and then also being able to kind of go back and take a look at the franchise they may not have seen before. So I wish they would have waited, honestly, until they could have brought it to theaters just so it could get some more legs. Cause I think it's a detriment to the film that it was not able to get that audience it could have gotten. It would never have been a blockbuster, but at least you would have got a little bit more out of it.
I just want to also address the elephant in the room that the day that it came out, we lost Chadwick Boseman. So it's just really easy to overshadow and to go back into old art, and even art that you haven't had the chance to appreciate yet. So that was definitely a hurdle that they had to either climb over or step aside.
Well, I'm glad you reminded me of that, Jeremy, because I forgot that was the case. But I actually had heard the news of Boseman right before I started watching the movie. And as I already said, this movie couldn't have come in a better year. That movie couldn't come in a better time than for me right then at that moment. Because, that was you needed that, again, that positivity. And that, Lou, you said, well, the pleasantness of that film right then.
Yeah. No, I agree with what both of you are saying. It's weird because I see what you're saying, Scott, and I think you're right. I think had this movie opened in theaters, I think it probably would have gotten some really good word of mouth, because I think there's a lot of people who would be like, oh, a Bill and Ted movie 30 years after the fact, pass. Only to find out, no, the people who saw it would say, hey, this is good, you should check it out and see if it could have some legs. But like I said, who knows? If this movie ended up doing more, you know, I don't know if we'll ever get the numbers on it, but it'd be interesting. But yeah, to know with everything, I know everybody's going through a lot right now, and we were going through a lot that weekend, and to have a movie this genial and fun and just there to put a smile on your face, I think was both sad that it didn't get a release, but it was also kind of perfect. So let's move on. Let's get into spoiler talk. And so now that you've seen that, if you want to avoid any major plot points, you can pause here and join us after you've seen the movie. But we're going to go ahead and get into spoiler alert. So I'm going to count you down. 3, 2, 1. Okay. Man, I can't believe they didn't save the world and everything just collapsed in on itself. Okay. No, that didn't happen. That's for anybody who like forgot to hit the pause button, was fumbling in their car.
Were you watching Tenet instead? And I haven't seen Tenet, so I don't know if that's the case or not. But
I mean, doesn't everything fold in on itself at some point in a Nolan movie? I mean, I just assume, right? But so let's go ahead and just talk about, I guess we talked a little bit about how the movie does find these characters 30 years later, basically, or I think in the film they do 25 years later.
They've moved Bogus Journey up to the 90s. Yeah. They retconned it.
That's fine. That's the first of several retcons that I was okay with. So they moved it up. How do you think the movie handled the aging of these characters and finding these two characters later? Because the movie operates with the premise that they didn't write the song that united the world, which is what we were led to believe at the end of Bogus Journey. And when we find them, they've kind of bottomed out and losers. What'd you think about that kind of jumping off point for the story, Jeremy?
How are they still married? And how are they living in beautiful homes? I'm not trying to be a turd, but being an adult, working 8 jobs, 4 passions, I don't understand.
You mean wedding singers don't get paid that much?
Were they singing professionally, or was it a family member's wedding? Because you must define wedding singer if we're going to make that a profession.
Well, we know they had one best-selling album and a couple that dropped off. So maybe they had a really good agent that invested their money for them, and they're doing fine.
Yeah, they got royalties. And we never learn what the princesses, because yes, the princesses are still here, once again recast. But we don't know what they do for a living. Maybe they are just living off their wives. That could be a possibility as well.
It's like a 60-year-old pool boy. Is that what we're saying? Like they're both 60-year-old pool boys and are wedding singers?
I mean, as pool boys go, you could do a lot worse than Keanu Reeves.
Well, that's what I was going to say. You know, Lou, you say, how do we deal with their aged selves? Keanu Reeves, I think, did some kind of human sacrifice back when he made Babes in Toyland, and that's where he stopped aging. And Alex Winters has not aged badly for 30 years. He's not doing bad either, so... I don't feel bad for either one of them.
No, they keep their youth very much. And so, yeah, I thought that the idea, the concept, it, you know, obviously it creates some sort of conflict because if we see them as people who have already saved the world, there's no world to save. So you gotta figure out something. So they are greeted. We find that they not only haven't saved the world with their music, but time's starting to collapse in on itself. So they send Kelly, the daughter of Rufus, to come visit Bill and Ted and offer a warning. And let's stop here because, yeah, obviously the one cast member that they couldn't bring back was George Carlin, although they do bring him in via hologram. They do from, you know, old footage. And Kristen Schaal plays Kelly, which is the name of George Carlin's daughter in real life. So that was a nice touch. What do you think about how they handled the departure of Rufus and the use of kind of Kelly as his placeholder, Scott?
Well, George Carlin is one of my favorite comedians of all time. He is one of the three wise men. So I was hesitant going into this because I remember an interview maybe 2 years ago now, where they said that there was going to be an homage to Carlin. But I think they did it well. They used some footage, and then when he's off camera, they have a voice double add a little bit more of what obviously he didn't record back in the 80s. Originally, from what I understand, the part of the daughter was actually written for Kelly Carlin. So I think there's a lot of love put into it. I don't think Carlin was overused, and I think it was nice to at least see him in this film.
I cried like a baby. They could have done anything because it was just a staple. I mean, he's guiding them through these original journeys, and he's the only one that believes in them. And I thought that they handled the character of Kelly beautifully. Sometimes it's hard to let character actors be character actors. Sometimes you just see, I know you from X, so you're going to be from X, but took a little bit, and then it finally clicked that this actress, Kristen Schaal, forgive me, I hope I'm saying that correctly, she's quirky enough to get away with it, and good for her. I mean, she's quirky enough to believe that these guys are going to save the world, and it was really exciting. I love the way they handled the hologram, and I love the dichotomy with the mother, too, with the great leader, because she's just so forceful. Like, I know this is going to be a thing, and we needed someone rooting for Bill and Ted, and it was beautiful to see the daughter of Rufus do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I liked the, in keeping with the kind of the light tone of the movie, they don't dwell on the fact that Rufus isn't around anymore. The theme of all these Bill and Ted movies is this is dopey fun. Go with it. Don't think too hard about it. The fact that they immediately identified her as Rufus's daughter, I was like, they put that together very quickly, but it doesn't matter because it's like, nope, this is who it is. We all know what the deal is, the audience is, and we're just going to go with it. I think it was, you know, when you have a good comedic actress, you know, who people know and like and recognize, they're like, oh, okay, this is fine now. I think she does a good job with, similar to what Carlin did in terms of being kind of just very straightforward about what is some very, you know, this is the one time this is the time travel trilogy that does not care about time travel whatsoever. Its rules, they have no rules. To quote Zaddy Hulk, either all of it's a joke or none of it is. And in this movie, all of it's a joke. So they set up the rules they don't even have the rules. They just say this, hey, go here. You can go here and you can go there and do whatever. And she's very straight-faced about setting it up. And then I like some of the bits they give her later on with a new character that we'll talk about in a minute. But so we're also introduced early in the film to we're reintroduced to these old characters, and we're introduced to the new characters of the daughters of Bill and Ted. We have Fia, or little Ted, and Billy, little Bill, who we last saw at the very end of Bogus Journey. Clearly a decision to go what was assumed to be two boys to two girls. So now they have two daughters instead of two sons. What do you think about the two young actors playing them? We had Samara Weaving as Thea, and we have Bridget Lundy Payne as Billy. How did you feel they fit into this world, Jeremy?
Well, as far as to make a comment on giving them a different gender to let them, you know, be whatever they wanted to be, or making us believe that they were guys, I think Scott knows this. And if anybody's heard the stuff that I've done before, it's we need more strong female characters. So I'm excited to see it. I mean, we've seen, I hope I'm not speaking before, but we've seen ourselves on TV for our entire lives. I'm really excited to see it go in a different way. And these two actresses just jumped right into it. And it takes a special kind of, I don't want to say unintelligence, I guess, earnest. It takes a special kind of earnest actor or actress to be able to jump into this role and make it believable to where it's not just over the top. Because, I mean, let's be honest, these two characters, you grow to love them or you hate them. It just, it's either or. And they're so, Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter they sell it so well that you believe they are these people. And Theo and Billy really jumped into it. And I don't know how they did it, but kudos to them for doing an amazing job. And you really, I felt at least that these were not clones of their parents, but had the best parts of it. And that must have been challenging to jump in those shoes, but I really enjoyed where it went.
Yeah, it could have been very, very easy for the actors and the director to allow this to just become a parody of the parents. And I think a lot of actors would have made that choice to just, you know, do your best Keanu impression and your best Alex impression and call it a day. But they didn't do that. But also, too, I think these two actors put together an innocence, which is what's going for all these characters, kind of an innocence, naivete. But they do show off a lot of intelligence in their what they're doing. Both the script allows that to happen, but also they are able to show that there's more going on upstairs than probably what's going on in Bill and Ted's head. You know, we find out that these two are not very much, not exactly musicians like their parents, but they are musical scholars, and they are able to have a recognition of musical theory and musical history, things that Bill and Ted would never have done. And this allows those characters to go off on their own journey, but also, again, makes them not just aping what these two other actors did 30 years ago. They're doing their own thing, and I really did appreciate that, because it could have been very easy to go the other route.
Yeah, it felt to me that you could have, because these two characters essentially do the plot of the first Bill and Ted, where they go through time and get historical musical figures, while Bill and Ted are leaping through the future to find the song that they think they have written that saves the world. So it's a twofer on this. They go into the past, Bill and Ted go into the future, and yeah, you're right. They could have really rehashed a lot of stuff, and on the surface they do, but it is couched with, you know, an evolution in that these two are dopey and very youthful, but also very smart. You know, they drop a lot of musical knowledge and musical references, which then ties into the end of the film where, you know, and this was the other retcon that they do, is that they keep saying in the movie that a song by Preston and Logan will save the world. And you can kind of piece together why they specifically say Preston and Logan and not a song by Bill and Ted, because ultimately they're the ones that write the song, start the band playing. And so they're the ones who put the song together, which is technically not what, what we're told in the first two movies, but who cares? It's fine. But what I like about it too, again, in that, it's another easy take that they could have done is they could have had the two daughters like hate their fathers and try to get some like wrought drama out of it. And what was so refreshing is that it's so clear that these two daughters admire or maybe are the two biggest Bill and Ted fans in the world that they just, and they're supporting them and propping and like lifting them up. And then, so at the end, when they're all together, everyone in this movie just really likes each other. And that's kind of rare to see that the conflict isn't coming from, you know, just forced melodrama. It's just, you know, hey, we all love each other, but we've got to go save the world now.
Yeah. I was going to say, obviously the whole Preston Logan thing, was made up for that reason. But I do like the choice they make at the end where a cliche would have been that the parents have to give away to the kids and that's what we're going to go with. But really it's not. It is a family endeavor. Mm-hmm. The daughters go ahead and get together the arrangement, but the guitar solos come in are the dads. So mm-hmm. Again, it could have been, we're now the old generation has to step aside and we're going to pass it on to the kids. But instead, it's these generations can work together to cut much like everyone across all time, which the sci-fi fan in me is going, huh? But okay, I'm just going to go with it. As Lou told me to, I'm going to go with it.
Yep.
Because they throw out all the time travel rules on this one. But it didn't fall into the cliche of the old guys have to step back, but it also allowed for that kind of intermingling of the generations, which was great.
Mm-hmm. The other easy thought to have would be, well, this is setting up for maybe a spinoff universe for these two characters. I've had some people say, oh, well, that may be what they do next. I don't think that's what is going to happen. I don't think anything else is happening. I think this is the definitive end of this trilogy. I don't think we're going to get like a Billy and Thea excellent adventure, but I thought that it was, yeah, like what you said, bringing them together and kind of them coming into this whole realization together as a family, I thought was a great end to that story and a great way to cap it. Instead of, like you said, yeah, no, we were only here to set up, you know, the Skywalker, you know, thing. We're only here because, and our child will be the one to save us, not us, which again would have been completely different than what we've been told for two previous movies. So they did marry that concept well.
Can we go back for a second and just talk about the importance of the educational aspect of all of this? There are so many bands that were influenced by bands that were influenced by bands. And I get the chance right now, my son is 2.5, and I have the wonderful opportunity to show him David Bowie, the Rolling Stones, but I also have the chance to inspire him and show him Muddy Waters and Buddy Guy. And it blew my mind in a beautiful way, the first musician that they went after, and they went back chronologically to essentially give credit where credit is due. I mean, because there's so many artists behind the scenes that you don't see. And it's just, you know, when you hear that the Stones wouldn't play unless they could have Muddy Waters play with them, or they could play in his, or record in his studio and do all these things. It's just they hit a mark with education and inclusion, and they let these young ladies, or these young people rather, tell that story. So we do get two stories, and we do get our, and I'm piggybacking off of yours by saying this is very possible the definitive end of it. And we already get our journey, but it's amazing that in the first excellent adventure, forgive me, we see, oh, they're going back for Beethoven. They're going back for this person. They're going back for that person. And for me, it's like buzzwords. It's like Napoleon. It's like, oh, you know, these people are famous. But with this one, I definitely saw a music education strategy, and it just really inspired me.
No, you're right. I think that was, yeah, exactly. I think you hit it right on the head. It's like, yeah, they get their journey and they get to do it. And yeah, and the choices of which, because there's a lot of artists they could have chosen, but you know, they go back and they get Jimi Hendrix, they get Louis Armstrong, they get Mozart, they get Ling Loon, and then they get Grom, which I thought was, that was maybe like the best choice of like this the original drummer back in the, what was it? I mean, the caveman era that they go all the way back. So supposedly the very first drummer. And so and it allowed them to do something that was similar to their dad's, but different, but then weave it all together. It's kind of what you're talking about. It was mind blowing about this is there's a lot that happens in what is an 84 minute movie. And the fact that it also all can happen and doesn't get bogged down, I think that's a real credit to the screenwriters. That this is a very tightly written movie that could have fallen apart really at any point. And the fact that it doesn't, I guess there's lots of minor miracles around here, because to go to the other side of what Bill and Ted's journey now, they have to go to the future and they have to, their idea is, well, let's go into the future when we have written the song, which is kind of a callback to what they do in previous movies where they go to the future after everything's worked out and then help themselves out in the past. So they're like, well, let's just do that again. And so they go do that and they can't find the song, but it allows them to interact with varying future Bill and Ted's as their lives continue to just get worse and worse. So let's talk about those scenes a little bit. What did you think about the choice to have Bill and Ted just kind of interact with all these varying weirdo versions of Bill and Ted, and which was your favorite version of them? Jeremy, we'll start with you this time.
That was actually what I was going to ask if I could share about, because we get these versions, these alternate realities that to me feel very plausible. Now, there are things that are amplified. There are things that are definitely written for fun, but I definitely could see a version of Bill and Ted where they do go to prison. I definitely could see a version of Bill and Ted where they are washed up. I could definitely see a version of Bill and Ted where they're con artists. And the writers carefully wrote those and wove those together in a point where I believed it, but again, you exaggerate things for film. And I love the fact that they exaggerated these things with these huge outfits and these huge personalities and these huge costumes. And the one thing that got me was how close they brought us to danger and then pulled us right back. Mm-hmm. That was really exciting, because they could have, I mean, you know, we know how long the movie's going to be, but I was so invested. I was watching these characters run through these multiverses essentially, and there was real danger, and it's very hard to do. But this is like, it's like five stories going on at once, because you still have the wives coming back and forth and you still keep the heart of the same movie. So I thought it was awesome. I don't want to go and tell the whole movie because I really want people to watch it, but I really enjoyed all of the alternate versions and how it was carefully written and pulled on the heartstrings.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I have nothing more to add. I agree.
Okay. Yeah. I will say what I really liked about it is this was something, and this was the other reason that I was excited for this movie, is that as much as I love Keanu Reeves, and there's a lot of superlatives we could give to him and way to describe his career, silly has never been one of them. He doesn't do, this is the only kind of silly movies he's ever done. You know, he's done mostly after this, he goes in to become action stars, or he does, you know, romantic dramas. I think the only other comedy, straight up comedy that you could put to him is The Replacements, and he's pretty much the straight man in that movie. So to see him get to do like goofy stuff, I get, you know, outside of, you know, his wonderful role in Always Be My Maybe, where he's great in that. To see him kind of cut loose and get to do some silly stuff with makeup and prosthetics and wigs and weird accents, all of that stuff was just, that was a delight. And you can tell, that's the other thing that you mentioned this earlier, Scott, the idea that this movie was a labor of love. It feels like it every time you see Keanu and Alex together, because you can tell, and if you've heard interviews, you know their friendship outside is genuine. It's lasted since they first met on the first Bill and Ted. And so the two of them having fun together seems just natural. They seem like they're having a lot of fun and getting to play silly dress up and do weird stuff. And that translates so clearly that it's infectious in what is, you know, still a very silly idea and silly movie. They nail it on that regard. And the other thing about that too, since we're up the journey of Bill and Ted, what I thought was an interesting choice and what I liked was Bill is kind of basically still Bill. Ted is not. Ted is more world weary, and Keanu plays it that way because if you watch the first films, he has got that kind of dopey charm where he's always smiling, and Ted doesn't really smile much at all in this movie because he's just got this kind of, you know, I won't say grizzled, but he's the one who's like, who feels like he's got the weight of the world on his shoulders. And so getting to give Ted other things to do, future Ted's, the abilities to be funny and silly lets you know that it's not just like Keanu giving like a sad sack performance, or, you know, he's making a deliberate choice. And it's the first time I think you could really say there's a difference between Bill and Ted, because I know that used to be the joke forever about which one's Bill, which one's Ted, because they're kind of the same character.
I think that I need to retract, or you've given clarity to my previous statement about having trouble finding their feet, because I just now made that connection where I was like, man, this is not Ted. And I have my own bias of, you know, this is Neo from The Matrix, because that's the last time that I saw him. And or John Wick. I mean, you can't be that guy and be John Wick.
No.
But when you chronologically go and you watch the movie and back, you think about the movie after you've seen all these characters, it's almost like he has to mentally prepare because he knows the storm that's coming if they do not write this song, if this doesn't happen, because I guess maybe these alternate realities are just very close to him, and he can maybe even see these of this isn't going to end well, and it's so heavy, and I definitely have to change my my opinion. It was the Ted that I wasn't ready to see because I didn't know the rest of the story, so I was assuming the young dopey Ted. And man, I can't express my excitement enough for Alex Winter, because he's just so earnest. He's so optimistic, and it's mm-hmm. all ignorance is bliss thing. And it's just like,
he's the old college buddy that every time you see him, he's going to be playing, hey, the songs that we played back in the day. Hey man, I don't, you know, we're all older. We can't hang like we used to, but we're going to try. We're damn sure going to try. He's pulling Ted along, and it's great. And it gives them, like, I won't say conflict, but it gives them a dynamic that's I think that's really interesting.
I think I agree that Keanu was given a position in the script to where he was the one who was questioning how things were going to go. But I don't know if world weary is, I think that's going too far, because as soon as they start the moving forward in time again, that all disappears. The only thing we really see is him saying that he's going to sell his Les Paul, mm-hmm. And he's worried about the wives. But really, even that, he's worried about the wives after he is told that the wives are going to leave them in the future. So I wonder if that is more taking one or two scenes or even lines and extrapolating more than even the movie is trying to extrapolate. I think both these guys are still pretty, you know, where they were in terms of personality.
The thing that I would also say though is that Keanu's line delivery in this movie is a lot more slower and deliberate than it is in the original films. He has the super energetic surfer bro talk in the first movie that actually kind of defined his career unfairly, I think, for a lot of reasons, because I think by this point, if you don't think the Keanu Reeves can act, you're fighting into a 30-year-old stereotype. But I that's where I get that from. I guess by world weary, I don't mean like he's an old gunslinger or anything like that. I just mean that there's there's a tiredness in his voice, even when things are going well, that it's like he's kind of like, he feels like he's the one that, like, he feels like more his age, I guess, than Bill does. I guess maybe is the other way to phrase that.
Yeah, I can see that.
But so they get to go off on a journey. Eventually, these journeys end up coinciding because, as Scott pointed out earlier, yes, they all die at some point. They all get killed by an evil robot, which I think is great. Because they're like, yeah, I mean, the last one had a Martian. This one has a robot. Why not? Let's just do it. Let's get weird. And so they're all killed by a robot. They go to hell. This allows the return of I think maybe one of the best characters of the whole series, and that's Death, the Grim Reaper, William Sadler being back. I was so happy to see him again. Jeremy, what were your thoughts on getting the return of the Grim Reaper?
I wanted to pause really quick, and I wanted to address Dennis Caleb McCoy. I thought, seeing the movie, that it was one of the guys from Workaholics or a comedian, and it fills my heart even further and makes me more a fan of this person. Do you guys know who it was?
Yes. Anthony Carrigan is his name, and he's mostly a character actor that has been on Gotham.
Yeah, he's an advocate for the disease that he has, and it's a very unique condition. And with his condition, it's almost as if he's been typecast to get certain roles that are villains. And he wore a full body suit in this, and he still portrayed a beautiful comedic performance. And again, like I said, I thought it was one of the Workaholics guys. I was like, oh my God, Adam Devine, I think it was. Just the way that he's just giving these lines, they're 100% believable. And I loved his performance even under this 45-pound suit or whatever that he was wearing. And don't get me wrong, I love Death. Like, I bawled my eyes out because I saw this dichotomy and just this bro love that he had for the people. And he just felt like he was just, I love it too much to divulge because I'll be laughing and crying at the same time. But the lines that they shared were just so poignant. And so just, they were so wrapped up in their own success, and they talk like they were Motley Crue, or they talk like they were Poison, and it just all fell apart because we all got too big for each other. And like I said, I can't because I'll be laughing and crying at the same time, but I loved it.
You guys remember this guy as Death. To me, he'll always be Sloan, the head of Section 31. So, and that's a Star Trek reference that maybe one person listening will get. Enjoy the reference. Or he's the guy who shows up naked in Die Hard 2 at the beginning of the movie.
Mm-hmm. And Shawshank Redemption, and as the stuttering inmate in the Shawshank Redemption. Well, I'm sad.
No, he's definitely Section 31. Yeah. I'm just, yeah.
A great character actor. Just that's, I think that's what we're saying here.
Well, no, and I agree that he was the best part about Bogus Journey. I already said Bogus Journey to me is a better movie than Excellent Adventure. I did like, I like the whole, and he ties into it, the whole, like, they are failed artists, and they go through the whole thing. So you have, like, their first album hits it big. They're one-hit wonders. And then every album after that, they are trying desperately to find that again. So they try different, like, genres. They try different they have, like, the holographic logo on the cover of one of their albums. And then, obviously, the bass player feels that he was the only one really providing the music. So he goes off and does a solo gig, which we did see in Bogus Journey in one of the headlines. So, I mean, it's just, I love how they just kind of continue to play off the whole idea of these guys had their one hit, and like every other one-hit wonder, they have the same kind of steady decline that they all do.
Yeah, I thought the bringing of, I liked how they brought him in. I thought he was used well. I, of course, could have gotten more from him. Because I think every line is, his line delivery is just impeccable. I think everything he says is funny. And going back and watching Bogus Journey, I think that's the same way. I think he's just aces. And I'm glad you brought him up, Dennis Caleb McCoy, the sensitive robot, the emotionally insecure time traveling robot. Is great, and we get to see more of his character and him and Death. Now that's a spinoff I'd watch. I would watch Dennis Caleb McCoy and Death I'd watch their Excellent Adventure. But I can't say enough. It was good to have him back. Of all the characters they could bring back, you got to bring back Death. They also bring back Deacon, Ted's little brother, who is now married to Missy, which I thought was a great continuity of that character and joke of, you know, she's married to Bill's dad, then she's married to Ted's dad, and then she marries Ted's brother. Like, I don't even want to get into the timeline of that. So we're just going to leave it. But it's hilarious. It's a great use and a great way to bring her in. Ted's dad shows back up. And there actually is a nice little thing where at the very end, Ted's dad actually finally reconciles with him and actually learns to believe in him. He's the one like naysayer in the group. And so even by the end of the movie, even he's going with everything and he's, you know, his heart opens up. So again, just warmth all the way around from all of, these characters are given, I don't know, reverence isn't the right word, but if you're fans of the film and fans of these characters, you're not going to be disappointed because they think they treat them all well.
I wanted to talk about Station. Did anybody else get it? Okay. Yes. Okay. I didn't know if we're going to address it. It was just like when I made that connection, I was like, oh my God. And my wife has no idea because she's never seen it. And she just, but yeah, so I just want to make sure that's a point in what we're going to talk about.
But again, this helped my brain melt. Because I'm a person who actually tries to, you know, look for sci-fi rules that are followed by a movie, and this movie follows none. So Station is an alien who, by the way, is dead to begin with because he's in heaven. How does this rapper who I don't know but knows physics really well know who Station is? My brain melted. I don't get it.
Well, that is, I guess, you point out that is maybe the one, and we can get into this now since we're hitting here of things that, you know, and any criticisms that we have of the movie. Yeah, Station's like the one character they don't bring back. They just reference him, Kid Cudi. So would we believe that Kid Cudi's not Station, right?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's I actually, when I started to try to make this work in my head, because again, I think my head works this way, I'm thinking to myself, Doctor Who. So you're thinking to myself, okay, maybe much like the face of Bull, Kid Cudi is going to turn into Station. He's already got the physics. I don't know. I'm trying.
No, I think.
By the way, this is not a complaint. I'm just.
I think Station regenerated as Kid Cudi. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, okay. I worked with Kanye for a while, I guess, for no reason.
It's very possible that Station regenerated into Kid Cudi, and that's the reason why he knew every single thing that was going on, because if you notice, he pops in exactly when they need him, and then he disappears exactly when he's not needed, and he had all of the answers. And I really feel this is a nod to inclusion, because the best musicians on the planet happen to be, you know, Jimi Hendrix happened to be, and then they're going to give credit where credit's due, say, you know what? It could be anybody. Station can be anybody. And for this movie, we are going to have it be Kid Cudi.
I'm stamping that as canon. I don't know if that's, I like that interpretation a lot because it ties up my complaint of, well, where would Station be? Wouldn't they want Station to help them through this? But, and the fact that Kid Cudi, yeah, the joke is that Kid Cudi knows more about time and space than anybody else. And on that, that's like, oh, that's really kind of funny that this rapper seems to know everything about the multiverse. But if he actually at the end reveals himself to be Station, I think that's fantastic. I co-sign that 100%. And then to your point, Scott, it would explain why Conway's music has sucked so bad once he stopped working with Kid Cudi. Kid Cudi was the genius there. And I also like the fact, as you pointed out, Jeremy, Kid Cudi, obviously, yeah, they're like, okay, we need like a modern day figure in here and we're going to get Kid Cudi, but we're not going to like include him in the greatest band ever. Cause that would be like a little much to say. No disrespect to Kid Cudi, but not putting him on the level of some of the greatest artists of all time might have been an overreach, and the fact that they don't was a nice touch
for Kid Cudi to come in and grab the hearts of young fans and be on stage, mm-hmm. and then reveal, oh, guess what? I'm the smartest being on the planet, and you're not going to understand that unless you peel back these layers of onions. I think I think that's a rad writing decision, and it makes you go on your own journey. Mm-hmm. But if he was like in the movie singing his own songs, because this is a Bill and Ted movie, I want that music. And I mean, we did get Kiss in the last one, but I don't know how many people knew that it was Kiss because they were covering it. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, and I was waiting for, at some point I was like, oh, they're going to do this song and Kid Cudi's going to have a weird, awkward rap in the middle of this. That's going to kind of like, no, and he didn't. I'd like, no, you're right. I think he was in the movie and they, I mean, used exactly right. Used perfectly to be like, cause yeah, I mean, if we were going to get the greatest rapper on earth, we probably wouldn't get Kid Cudi. I don't know. You know, we could, that's a podcast for another day. But yeah, used well, and it makes even more sense now that we've adopted the idea that he was Station the whole time.
I'm gonna stick with my Captain Jack face of bowl. He will become Station. Not that he was, but he will become.
All right. So let's get into it a little bit then. Any scenes or any criticisms? Anything about the movie that I guess didn't necessarily work for you? Could have been better, Scott. What say you?
Again, this is not a criticism because I learned, as they said, Rufus said, sometimes the ending will make everything make sense. So I knew the script writers told me, don't try to make sense of this. We're not trying to make sense of this, so you shouldn't try to make sense of this. Right. But again, my brain does this, so I was trying to make sense of this. Mm-hmm. And I wish I could have, in a 90-minute movie, I wish we could have had a 91-minute movie where they explained to me why two things. One, they didn't really explain to me the wives situation. I know what's going on, but I think there's a cut scene there with the wives and the costuming that show up and beckon them to the phone booth from the doctor's office. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, you know, it could be the older wives. It could be the daughters dressed as up to hide themselves, whatever. There's a missing scene there that would have been helpful. And then also an acknowledgement of, on the time travel side with the dads, is this them going through a steady timeline or are they doing interdimensional, multi-dimensional travel, which I think is what they were going for. And obviously mm-hmm. at the end, that's what they go for. But it would have been nice to say that for my brain not to melt.
Fair enough. Jeremy, what say you? Any response to that and or anything for the film that didn't necessarily work for you?
So we have to, again, go back to Rufus. It doesn't make sense until the end. And then again, throwing out all rules of time travel. This was the only movie where I've seen one talk to their self and the universe not imploding. That may be explained in a multiverse situation. But I still think that'd be detrimental things, you know, the butterfly effect, everything would be ripped into shreds. That's probably the only one, the fact that they got to interact with each other and that didn't destroy the universe. I think that the introduction of Kelly to young Billy and Ted, I don't want to say it was forced, but I think I would have enjoyed a different interaction instead of just dropping it off. They happen to be home and then we're just going to jump on this journey. I think both of those characters were smart enough to stumble upon their own origin story. And I think in order to move the plot and have these seven stories coincide with each other, I mean, because if they're going to make the conscious effort to go after Armstrong and Hendrix, they're going to be rooting around and investigating things. And I think it would have just added to the gumption of the new, you know, the two new leads. But yeah, I mean, that's about it. Just running into each other and not having the universe explode and then letting young Bill and Ted just investigate on their own and have, you know, turning over their own rock, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd agree with you, Scott. I do think the princess's role is a little underwritten. There is a side story there that we don't quite get, and it didn't quite click with me what was happening. That they seem to be being led on by their future selves, but to what point? Or maybe I think the point was that the future selves take them to all these different points in time and they see alternate realities, but they make the decision that they'd rather stay with Bill and Ted no matter what. But that never lands because we don't ever get to see them do that. we're just told through exposition, and that doesn't, so it's like, oh, who cares? Oh, their characters went through an arc off screen. They did, to bring back Zaddy Hulk, they did the same thing that happened to Bruce Banner in those 5 years in Endgame. It's like, oh, this sounds like this was kind of an emotional revelation for you. Wish we could have seen it. That'd have been great. I'd agree with that. I was going to go back to say that, you know, I was disappointed in No Station, but Jeremy, you covered that for me. So great. So I'm going to give you the biggest flaw in the movie and almost ruins the film. And that is, I have not been able to find myself in it yet. I, like many people, submitted an air guitar video to be included in the montage. I'm not in the montage. I'm not bitter.
Well, there's that one where it pans out and it's like all the videos make the earth. You're in there.
You're just
going to get your magnifying glass out and a lot of time.
Yes, I've tried it. I have tried to freeze frame.
I'm seeing you with like the spectacle up on the TV.
I've got it on my iPod or my iPad, and I'm just like zooming in.
Enhance.
I'm like
enhance.
Zoom in, enhance. Zoom. It's like CSI. I have yet to find my thumbnail.
Can we punch it? Can we punch in?
Yeah. I'm going to chalk it up to I forgot about it until the day it was due. Like I do most assignments, and didn't submit it till the last day. But no, that I mean, look. So yeah. If you're listening, creators, where's the Lou haircut of this movie? Yeah. That's what I'm asking.
Yeah, I that's what we want. To make this movie a 10 out of 10. I want my 2 minutes with the wives. That sounded bad. I want the 2 minutes of scenes in the movie with the wives, and Lou wants to see himself air guitaring.
Yeah. That's all.
You're not going to get a 10 out of 10 because you didn't do that.
Nope. So sorry, guys. But yeah. No. But I love that ending. I love that choice for the ending where, yeah, they did it. You know, they had this contest where people could submit videos of them dancing, and that's what they incorporate in the end, is just the world getting together and being happy and dancing and rocking out together. And it gets to the final point of the movie where, you know, they're able to connect space and time to play this one song together, which I thought not only is a beautiful sentiment, but it gets around the idea that whatever song they could write for this film, no one's going to listen to and say, yeah, that is the greatest song ever written. So it takes pressure off the film, off the creators of the film to do as well.
But as actually a fan of the Foo Fighters, I want to know what the Dave Grohl song is. That
sure.
Supposedly is like the best song ever written. I want to know what Dave wrote.
I'm sure it kicks ass. I mean, I'm sure
I think he stole that from Tenacious D, if we're going to do that, because he actually wrote the greatest song in the world. Just, I mean, Dave Grohl played drums, but...
That's true. So do we need a world where Tenacious D and Bill and Ted, we need a crossover there? Yeah.
But no, I mean, that quote at the end of the movie, Lou, you mentioned it already. I mean, that quote at the end of the movie basically is exactly what we need right now during the end of the world. At the end of it, it didn't really matter what the song was. It's just that we all were playing it.
I'm just excited that it wasn't R.E.M.
Mm-hmm. Oh. What if Shiny Happy People really would have saved the world? What if the world just needed the entire... Jeremy, would you commit? If it saved time and space, would you...
Or would you be committed?
Would you sing Shiny Happy People for the world, together in unison with the world?
I lost my religion, so no.
Right. Jeremy's the one guy in the background with the recorder, sadly playing into it because he has to, but keeping very very much the lyrics out of his head.
I would have brought a boombox and I would have played Everybody Hurts. Just, if we're going to talk about REM, we're going to go deep.
Yeah, no, it just was such a, and again, it encapsulates the theory of the movies, which is just, this is just about friends, and this is about togetherness, and the movie ultimately was about that. And yeah, the timing couldn't be more right for something like that, the idea of just people getting together and you know, being united over something happy for, you know, however, you know, for 4 minutes, which seems like a Herculean task anymore. But yeah, it ends the movie on such an uplifting note. Yeah, and as you pointed us out, Jeremy, yeah, it's surprisingly emotional. The movie itself is just this idea of everybody just getting together, and maybe part of it's because, you know, we can't be in big groups, so seeing all these people together in this, you know, singing this song together is something. Part of it is just the sentiment behind it, but you know, it just all, it all works in a way that it really shouldn't have, but does.
I think that the best thing that could happen for this IP is to go straight to Netflix or to Hulu, because I think it ran its course that it was going to. And as much as you guys have said it could have done better in the box office, well, we are products of a generation where it went to VHS and it went through the roof. It went to streaming and it went through the roof. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm not out of context by saying this, that it's going to get dark before it gets light again. And we are all headed for a really, really crazy roller coaster ride. And I'm not trying to, you know, make specific points about where we're going, but in the next couple months, this is what we need. Mm-hmm. So I would love to see this go, you know, to your streaming services. And it also gives them a boost because, I mean, I'm not talking Seinfeld money where they're just going to sell the same IP three times, but I really feel that it would give them a revenue boost for all the people that worked on it. And it would also give everyone that didn't get that chance to see it, a chance to see it and to feel the same that we have, because essentially if you've got the movie on for 5 minutes, you're going to find something you like.
Yeah. Well, and to your point too, this isn't like a Mulan or a Tenet that costs a few $100 million to make. This was a $25 million movie. It's a really relatively low budget movie. So I would, you know, my hope is that it did well enough on VOD to make, not only make its money back, but to make a profit. But like you said, you know, find its way to a streaming platform where people can watch it over and over again if they haven't bought it already. I think most people should buy it, especially if you're fans of the franchise. But, you know, I can understand why if you're, you know, not the hugest Bill and Ted fans in the world, why you would maybe want to wait. And if you do, that's fine too. But yeah, it's a really pick me up, and it is a great summer movie, which is the other shame in that this movie was supposed to get released in early August, and it's the exact kind of movie you would want to go see on a summer day when you want to just have a good day, you know, go see something that's just fun and entertaining. And because even summer blockbusters can be kind of heavy and emotionally wrought sometimes, and this isn't that. This is just a good time and something that's just going to put a smile on your face and keep it there. So before we wrap this up, are there any other scenes, moments, characters, anything that we didn't talk about that you want to get off your chest before we wrap this up, Scott?
No, I joke that, you know, Keanu sacrificed a human child back when he made Babes in Toyland so he doesn't age. So the meta line for me is, and I'm blanking on what the actual quote was, but when he's hanging out all the instruments, he goes, "I'm basically an omnipotent being." I'm like, yeah, Keanu, you are. We all knew it. I'm glad you claimed it.
He is a being of goodness and light, and we are lucky. We are lucky to have him, and we are lucky that he has never gotten himself canceled.
Now I look forward to watching him kill about 150 people in John Wick 3.
Can't wait. Can't, like,
the dichotomy there is amazing.
It is. He is. He contains multitudes, and he just keeps giving. He is. He's great. Although I gotta say, it's so odd to see him without facial hair. That was the thing that put me off about watching this movie. It's like, why he? I know he like doesn't look like he looks different, and it's like, I think he's had that beard for, you know, a good 7-8 years at this point. So him clean shaven, that was the one thing that threw me off. But yeah, Jeremy, how about you? Any thoughts, lines, moments, scenes that we didn't discuss?
It's that SWAT van going out of hell. That SWAT van just goes up like a helicopter. I couldn't.
Again, my brain melting. So SWAT vans can die. Mm-hmm.
They can go to hell.
Because they even point out the robot shouldn't be there. She's pointing it out. Like, you're a robot. You're not. How did you die? But the SWAT man dies.
You right now, Scott, are mirroring what my wife was like watching the first two Bill and Ted's with me this week. Because showing a movie from the 80s to somebody who's never seen it and doesn't have the nostalgic tie was a interesting experience, because she was just like, why? Wait, you know? And we've had so much good sci-fi and good time travel traveling movies over the years that you have to forget that in 1989 it's like no one cared. Like, we had Back to the Future, they like went to one place and that was it. No, this one, they jump all over the place and no one cares. You just have to.
You know, I was gonna say, but at least with the first two movies, and again, I'm not complaining. I enjoyed this movie a lot, but at least with the first two movies, like, they played with it too. Like, well, we need to have the keys to the prison cell, but if after we're done with all this, we go back and then get the keys and then bring the keys back, we'll have the keys. That's actually kind of makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so the fun stuff like that I enjoy. It's just I want like two more minutes of timey-wimey goodness. That's all I'm asking.
we talked about it again. Just you got to be able that is the rule to this film, to these all three of these films, is you just have to go with the nonsense. Like the second one, you mentioned the second one being better. I don't know if I'll go that far to say it's better than the first, but it is absolutely weirder. Like, they go to hell, they get a Martian, they go time traveling, they meet God, they do so, like, they just, and so by that point you do have to just, okay, they're just going for as much weird stuff as they could fit in and put it all with the just a kind of a dopey smile and a disarming, you know, Keanu's disarming presence, and you'll just go with it.
Well, yeah, and nearly over 30 years later, it's still the same case that usually sequels are retreads because, hey, if it works once, it's going to work again. Mm-hmm. So I still give Bogus Journey a lot of credit for basically saying, we made a hit. We didn't expect it to be a hit. The studio is giving us more money. Let's do something stuff crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I was good for NPR.
Yeah,
you don't do that with sequels. You never do that with sequels. And the fact that a Bill and Ted franchise did it,
mm-hmm.
I was pretty impressed with Bogus Journey.
No, and it holds up, by the way. If you haven't seen it in a minute, you can buy, by the way, you can buy the bundle of all, which is the other smart thing. Now, you could buy this movie separately, or you could buy the trilogy. I think it was like $35 total, which is worth it if you haven't. So, but yeah, I recommend going back and watching all three of them. And because, yeah, you do find that the first one is maybe more palatable. The second one is fun to watch to see how weird they get, and then the third one is just the ties everything together. So it's a really sound trilogy at the end of the day, and that's a hard thing to do. That's a hard thing to make three movies that fit each other, that complement, and that are all that are all good. So
J.J. Abrams couldn't do it. So
no, The Godfather couldn't do it.
True.
I'm on record. The Bill and Ted trilogy, better than the Godfather trilogy. Heard it here first. Brandon Davis just had blood shoot out of his ears.
Was it our group chat where somebody was talking about how they're doing another cut of the Godfather 3, and I said, now with more incest?
They are, yes. So,
okay.
Okay. So, okay, I'm going to wrap this up. We'll get some final thoughts here. It's certainly not the Godfather, but it's maybe the Godfather of, you know, surfer dude time traveling movies.
It's still better than Godfather 3, so we're
still
fine.
Better, yeah, still better, and you can see two of these the length of one Godfather 3. So I would certainly recommend that. But I will say, yeah, like we said before, this, if you're, you know what you're getting into with a movie like this, and I think the bottom line is, I don't think they could have done a movie like this better. This movie knows exactly what it is. It does it exactly what it wants to do, and does it exactly the way it should have done it. It is fun. It's a good time. It doesn't take itself too seriously, and it allows the audience to just have fun for 90 minutes, which is all these movies were ever really about. So it's not something that you need to think too much about, or you really should think too much about. It's the perfect kind of movie to turn your brain off for a little bit and smile for 90 minutes, and really a good escapist movie. And also an escapist movie that I think has some emotional moments. So I think it's a definite recommend. I think we're going to take this. I think we usually do one to 10 on full disclosures. I usually don't get to do full disclosures because I don't get to see new movies in the theater. But since we got VOD, I might be on full disclosure all the time now. Who knows? I'm going to give the movie a 9. I think it's really good. I'd give it a 10, but I'm not in it. But I think, is it going to win any awards? of course not, but it does exactly what you want it to do. And it's incredibly deeply satisfying. Jeremy, how about you? 1 out of 10, where would you put Bill and Ted Face the Music?
This one goes up to 11.
All right. Sounds great. Scott, how about you?
Yeah. I know you started by saying this, and I just want to say it again. This movie is an innocent movie. It is a fun, lighthearted movie, but I think it is very important to realize that this movie actually has a message and it does it well. So I don't want to downplay the fact that this movie is punching above its weight class. And I think that needs to be said. So because again, my brain melted, I'm going to give it 9 Napoleons on a water slide out of 10.
All right. Well, thank you both very much for coming on. It was great getting to not only watch the movie, but talk about it. And hopefully everybody goes out and sees it. Support it. I think it deserves it. But in the meantime, support us at the Front Row Network. You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter, at Front Row Reviews with a Z. You can find us on nprillinois.org under the Community Voices tabs, where you can find links to all of our main feed shows. I know we've got tons of stuff coming up. I know I recently did a guilty pleasure on Gremlins 2, talking about another sequel that gets weird and gets great because of it.
And it's also better than the original.
It is fantastic. So I had a lot of fun talking with your co-host, Scott, with Ryan and Jay Hoffman. And we had a good time with that. And also coming up, we're going to do another one from 1990. We're going to talk Dick Tracy. We're getting ready to record that. And we're also going to be doing Rhinestone, which has no anniversary, but there's never a bad time to talk about Sylvester Stallone and Dolly Parton teaming up.
I would beg to differ, but go right ahead. You enjoy that.
No, I'm excited. We're going to have the hosts of the excellent new podcast Double Threat joining us. And my lovely wife is very excited to get to sit through a Dolly Parton movie again. So it's win-win. But you can find me on Twitter at the Fake Blue Hair. Let me know what you think. Jeremy, tell us a little bit about your show and where people can find you.
It's all under at Lincoln's Legends. And what I do is this is the Front Row Movie Reviews is a national brand, and mine's more of a local thing. Sorry, I can't talk today. And I really just interview people that inspire me. I've got some cool episodes coming up. Basically, I find people that are really inspiring. And for the next episode, I'm going to tie in Drive-Thru Records, the Red Jumpsuit Apparatus, and a web developer from Chatham. So that's my tease for that. But it's all at Lincoln's Legends.
Dude, you saying Drive-Thru Records just brought back so many high school flashbacks for me. Not even funny. I know. I was a punk pop kid. I know.
Yeah, I'm pretty stoked about it.
All right, Scott, you got anything? You going to be doing anything with the Front Row soon? You still knee-deep in Springfield school board shenanigans?
I'm gonna crawl into my time machine / telephone and hit the infinity button, and maybe I'll appear from time to time. I would love to get more involved again, but life is interesting, and we'll just leave it at that. So I'll be around.
All right.
I know I'll be doing the flashback for First Contact sometime in 2021, because, well, you guys don't talk Star Trek without me. I don't allow it.
It's cute that you assume there's going to be a 2021, but anyway. On that hopeful note, I look forward to it. I look forward. Thank you for listening. I hope everybody, whatever you're doing right now, you're enjoying yourselves. We're going to keep doing as much content as we can for the Front Row Network for NPR Illinois. You can find us anywhere. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. In the meantime, hope you're out there and being excellent to each other. But until next time, for the Front Row Network, I'm Lou Hare.
Sitting in, I'm Jeremy. Very excited to be here.
I'm Scott, your multidimensional being.
And as always, we'll see you in the front row.